Sound Effect Podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Asbjørn Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com. In this episode, we're stepping back in time. Oscar-winning re-recording mixer and supervising sound editor Skip Livesay talks about what it was like to work on the Coen brothers' beloved film, Barton Fink. He talks about his 38-year collaboration with the Coen brothers, what it was like to work on a film pre-Pro Tools, how he found inspiration for creating the Barton Fink mosquito, the Barton Fink door whoosh, and the never-ending hotel desk bell ring that stole the MPSE award win from the Terminator 2 sound team, and much more. I'm also really happy to let you know that the independent sound community has just kicked off an early summer sale at asoundeffect.com/sale with excellent deals on hundreds of sound libraries, plugins, and instruments, great one-day deals, plus bonus sounds with any order. Hop on over to asoundeffect.com/sale to get the freshest sounds out there and to support the indie sound community.
Hey, Jennifer Walden here for Sound Effect. Joining me is Skip Livesay at Warner Brothers Sound in New York City. So although Skip doesn't need an introduction, I'm going to do it anyway. Skip has won an Oscar for his incredible mix on Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity and also earned Oscar noms for sound editing and mixing on his film Roma, as well as for the Coen brothers' films True Grit and No Country for Old Men, and for mixing the Coen brothers' film Inside Llewyn Davis. So among his other award wins, let's not forget that MPSE award win for Foley and effects editing on Barton Fink in 1992. And that's really what we're here to talk about today, the outstanding sound of Barton Fink. So May 18th is the 32nd anniversary of the film's premiere, which was at the Cannes Film Festival in 1991. Without further ado, here is Skip Livesay. Hey, Skip, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Hi, you're welcome. Sure, my pleasure.
So we're talking about Barton Fink, a much beloved film by the sound community, and it's been covered so many times, the sound of this film. So much has been said about it already. So hopefully I have some new and interesting questions for you. Let's actually start by talking about your collaboration with the Coen brothers. You've done like all 18 of their feature-length films, starting with the first one, Blood Simple, back in 1984, through their latest release, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, in 2018. And you've also worked with Joel Coen on The Tragedy of Macbeth in 2021, and Ethan Coen's Jerry Lee Lewis, Trouble in Mind. So that's 38 years of making films together. I mean, that's just incredible. So what makes this creative collaboration works so well?
I think it's really that I just do whatever they tell me to do and don't ask them too many questions, basically. they said recently I got an award, and they sent a message over, a statement saying how happy they were that I had gotten this award, because it seemed to verify the possibility that I knew what I was doing. They since they've only worked with me, they have no idea whether I'm any good or not. Yeah, it's about that, I guess. I mean, it's about friendship, really. What could be more exciting than a long-term relationship with people you like?
Yeah, and so much creative trust there. I always loved their bold use of sound on all of their films. So, you know, that must be really fun for you to just go for it, right? They don't hold you back.
You know, it's interesting. I think a lot of it had to do with just that moment in history where in Hollywood, a lot of films were kind of exploding, and there was a lot of, well, before Barton Fink and certainly before Blood Simple, there were a lot of big, wild movies being made in Hollywood, but not so much in New York. I mean, if you think of Woody Allen as an example, and even Martin Scorsese, the films that were being made in New York weren't big Hollywood epics. And the tradition in New York was more about drama and dialogue, et cetera. Not so much about sound effects and spaceships and war movies, or I don't know, however you want to break it down. And Joel and Ethan kind of arrived on the scene at a time when one could make a big movie like, say, Hudsucker Proxy in New York and have no downside to it. And I don't know if they drove that or the technology drove that possibility, but there it is. They had no really restraint on their ideas for sound for their movies, and so they kind of went for it. And I would say that I was lucky enough to be sucked into the vortex. And I had a similar, I mean, just maybe not by so much by coincidence. I was a young sound person in New York, ready and willing and able to try anything. And I was looking for an opportunity. And maybe opportunity was looking for me. I'm not sure. But in any event, we hit it off. And we had similar interests. And I think we had similar aesthetic within art and movies and music. And even though I'm not a very big Bob Dylan fan, I think they gave me a hall pass on that, I suppose. But, you know, we collided, all of us. We all were young and eager and easily impressionable.
It's funny you say you're not a Bob Dylan fan, but you did the sound on Inside Llewyn Davis, and I loved that film. And there's the young representation there of Bob Dylan in that movie. So I guess that was pretty good for the Coen brothers. Pretty happy to do that.
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of things. You don't get to choose your friends, and you certainly don't get to influence their tastes in music. So yeah. I won't hold it against them.
Yeah, right. So you had mentioned technology before, and Barton Fink was released in 1991, which was before Pro Tools was actually released. So what did the audio post-process on this film look like? And what were some of the technical challenges that you had in creating the sound of this film?
Well, we had started a company, me, myself, and Phil Stockton was my dialogue editor. He and I cut dialogue together often, but with challenges like this, I also had my sound editor hat that I would put on. And we had some computer editing gear that we bought. I mean, basically, our company was about these workstations that were made by a company called New England Digital. And we had a couple of recorder editors to record Foley and edit Foley. We had our own Foley stage on 27th Street. I think we had two workstations to cut sound effects on, which were computer workstations. And Barton Fink, I'm almost certain we did the dialogue in ADR on Mag, 35 Mag. So we had some other workstations, editing rooms. Yeah, I don't think you can actually call a movie a workstation. So the dialogue editing rooms were on Mag. And it was kind of a breakthrough moment where we had Eugene Garrity, a sound designer, a friend of mine, a very good friend, and I sort of schemed up this idea that if we could devise a facility that was productive, we could make enough money to pay the mortgage on these editing systems. And they were very expensive, right? Stupidly expensive. But we had, in our editing rooms, we had a tool where we could record and manipulate sound in a digital workstation, which allowed us to do a lot of experimentation. We had a kind of a hallway to editing and mixing within the same box, which was kind of a crucial step for the realization of what the sounds could be. And that is the other part. The other very important part was we could present the design to the Coens, and we could then adjust it. Not within the mixing studio, but within the editing room environment. And it was a pretty big threshold, really. So we were lucky enough to get our money together so we could have these workstations. And then we're also lucky enough to have Joel and Ethan as our clients who were interested in using the workstations. And it is really not much different than the way we use Pro Tools now. It's just a different piece of gear.
And less tracks, right? I mean, the track count was probably...
The track count, well, okay. The Synclavier had, it was all RAM-based. So there were RAM chips on a board. And my Synclav, I think, had 24 megabytes. And I think that's around 10 minutes of stereo recording. And what you would do is you prepare sequences, small little handbag of sound effects, and edit them against picture. And the Synclav could sample the sounds, and you could also, it had a sequencing program. So you could edit and sequence against picture. And then you could do a whole bunch of mixing and stuff within that sequence. And then at a certain point, it fills up with RAM and there's no more room for anything else. So you would start a different sequence or a new sequence within the same area. Like, let's say, as an example, you had a two-car car chase. You could have one sequence for car A and another sequence for car B. And you had to, you still had to use, unfortunately, the idea was to be able to play enough stuff to present it rather than having to use your imagination so much and remember what was being covered on other places. But in general, you could have, like most of the sequences, maybe all of the sequences in Barton Fink, we were able to record the sound effects, edit them, sequence them, and play them back for Joel and Ethan as a unit. Like, for instance, the sequence where Barton goes into the movie studio and the studio executive says, you know, it's a wrestling picture. And he calls up Tony Shalhoub and says, yeah, show him what you're doing. Show him the wrestling, the dailies. So he goes to the screening room and watches the dailies of this literally wrestling picture. And he kind of lapses into unconsciousness. And we push into his head in some way. So it goes from subjective to objective. And we're hearing it the way he's hearing it in this moment of desperation. I know we had enough room to play all those sounds together. And I made some adjustments and it just kept getting better and better. But having that computer in your editing room doesn't get it to the mix room. So we'd have to then take the parts and transfer them to 35 mag and then bring them up to the stage and re-record them within the mix, which we did with Lee Dichter. And I have to say that was one of our finest hours. In terms of enjoyment, we had more fun making that mix, I think, than any other mix. And I think the outcome was also spectacular. We were all so pleased and Lee did a great job. And it's one of my fondest memories of our time together.
So if you had today's technology and resources, would you have done the sound differently from a creative standpoint? And what, if anything, would you have done differently?
Well, Pro Tools gives us more tracks, but it's more of a tape recorder than the Synclav is. The Synclav is, you tend to work on a few sounds at a time and do a bunch of fiddling and processing, and then that gets saved to a hard drive. Whereas the Pro Tools is basically you do your work and then it's on a track in a basically a tape player. And I do the same things to the sounds in Pro Tools that I did in the Synclav. But, you know, the Synclav is a fantastic, beautifully weighted keyboard. And there are a few things you can do with the Synclav that are just really fun and easy to do. And you don't have that same interface, really, with it's all really the big difference. And probably, I'm not sure anyone would be willing to give up unlimited track space for a keyboard interface. But, and of course, the other part of it is that now I mostly mix and I spend much of my time mixing dialogue and music. And I usually have what we call a wingman cutting sound effects and mixing the sound effects side of the mix. And we've been working that way for a very long time, ever since Fargo, I guess. And I work that way on most or all of my projects. And that's the big difference, is that we were lucky enough to be trying to edit and process sound in a workstation at the same time that Pro Tools and other people were trying to create a mixer in a box, as they call it, where you can mix and make your mix decisions in a Pro Tools environment. And it's all saved and beautifully available to make fixes and corrections and picture changes, which were some gigantic monumental issues in that very beginning time, which was the beginning of, in the early 90s. And now all that stuff is, myself and the young people who we're working with take that for granted now.
I think Barton Fink would probably be well suited to the Dolby Atmos format because there are things happening in the room above him and there's things happening to the rooms beside him. There's all of these great off-screen events happening. And I think this would have been like a great movie to remix in Atmos.
I totally agree. I hope someday we'll be able to do an Atmos version of that film and Lebowski and Hudsucker and the other movies, which actually we did do an Atmos mix of Macbeth. We mixed the movie in Atmos and basically everyone requires a minimum of home Atmos. And it's actually so much easier to work in theatrical Atmos for us and then crash it down to the versions from there. So Joel didn't seem to mind, and it can be pretty transparent. We didn't do a lot of zooming around the room type stuff that you think of when you hear the word Atmos. And the same thing really goes for all the other versions, like Blood Simple was mono originally, and when we moved on to Raising Arizona in stereo, that was Dolby Stereo. Joel and Ethan had a reluctance to have a lot of stuff happening in the surrounds, or surround, actually, in Dolby Stereo, it's a mono track. And then when 5.1 arrived and Dolby Digital, they never really liked stuff happening in the surrounds. And so no like hard door slam, gunshot, etc. in the surrounds. But there's plenty of music and atmosphere in the surrounds, and we just didn't tell them. They never minded it. There were no exceptions taken, but occasionally they would hear something and they say, "What are you doing?" And we would either tuck it in or change it up in some way. But they've never been big fans of extending the audio to the surrounds.
Interesting. Okay. In an article you did with Focus Features in 2009. You said, "I would say Barton Fink is a crowning achievement in terms of sound design and effects. On that movie, we were able to help progress the story and help get what they wanted in terms of an abstract and non-linear sound." Can you expand on that? Like, why do you think that Barton Fink is a crowning achievement in terms of sound design? And can you share some examples of the abstract sounds that you used and talk about their role in helping to progress the story?
You know, we all, within the group, we all think of that movie. And I also like to include The Man Who Wasn't There, the Barbara movie, as movies where we all tried to achieve a certain thing, and we did. We got very close to what our aspirations were. Barton Fink, particularly because it happened early on when the tools were sort of basic, or at least our understanding of the tools were more basic, at least for me. I was speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for anyone else, but understanding what to do and how to do it was more fresh, I think, in those times. And there was a joy of discovery, which we still have, but not quite as deeply as we had on Barton Fink. And Barton Fink, as well as the Barbara movie, I think those movies have a very sophisticated narrative, as the people say. That's what they call it now, story. And there was a lot of things happening that needed to happen sound-wise. And certain things were required to be conveyed by sound in order for the audience to understand what the story was and what was happening. And that just doesn't happen all that often. Usually it happens by some dialogue, you know, or a gunshot, etc. More abstract ideas, particularly people's inner thoughts and their mood and the sense of danger or any other sort of emotional context, is usually not the milieu of the sound effects. And getting those ideas out there with the sound design and the mix was very challenging and also very rewarding. And I guess that's why we love those movies, in particular Barton Fink, so much.
Any specific examples of abstract sounds that best represent your approach to that, to using abstract sounds to further the story?
I know. There's a sequence where John Goodman, who's living next door, hears Barton Fink, and he comes over, and you hear him come through the hallway, come over and knock on the door. And he comes in and he says, what happened? And Barton doesn't want to tell them that the Judy Davis character is now lying dead in the bed. And he kind of passes out a little bit. And there's a very nice little segue, which we made with a European train sound. And as I recall, a ringing bell. And although it seems subtle, is not very subtle at all in the movie. It's quite clearly a bit of a journey. Then there's also the totally bizarre sex scene that precedes that, where they're hugging in bed and then it ends up Barton looking at the bathroom sink and the camera travels over and down into the plumbing. It's not so much abstract to the story. It's quite clear what we're trying to say with the sound and the image. But the sound effects that we use are abstract and strange from the real world. And that was, I guess that's really what Barton Fink was about, was how can we do these things without getting in trouble,
basically. Yeah.
what's legal here?
The score and the sound design work together so well. And this was something that you brought up in, it was like a featurette on one of the DVD bonus features, Headspace, the inner sounds of Barton Fink. Mm-hmm. And you brought up the fact that the score and the sound design work together so well. And there's that scene with Barton looking up in his hotel room and he's listening to the sounds of banging and dragging and thumping. And that leads into the next scene with a close-up of the typewriter and the abstract sounds of typing as Barton sits waiting in Geisler's office and the secretary's typing away. Can you talk about your collaboration with composer Burwell? Like, what was that process like back in, 1990 when you were working on this?
Yeah, well, we all hit it off so well. I'd known Carter for a while, but when he came along at the very beginning and Joel and Ethan got to be friends with him, and we kind of, our gears meshed, I suppose, because I knew Carter and I was kind of aware of the process in a way that worked for our purposes. We had the idea that we could audition stuff and send samples back and forth between Carter and I, and we could make it a little more clear what was happening. And this was one of the things about having the workstation where we could make sound effects that Joel and Ethan could approve, and then I could make a mix and send them to Carter, and he could see just what we were doing. And the same goes for Carter. He made some more of an analysis of things happening, and he said, well, you have these sound effects of this kind of thunderous track, so there's no need for me to have all of this percussion or that type of percussion, so I won't put that in and we'll let the sound effects play that part of the scale. And in a lovely way, it's more about the kinship and the friendship where we agree to work together and sort out our ideas. And, we could always adjust stuff. That's the part that people don't often realize. No matter what you do, if your best intentions are not really doing it, then let's make an adjustment. So we all had the deal that we could put our best foot forward, and then if that didn't work, then we could revisit it rather than have a lot of stuff in there and have to sort it all out. Let's make everyone's best intentions the only plan, and then we'll take it from there if it fails. We meshed pretty well, and that's because we had this dialogue where, in essence, we divided up the scenes and said, you should do this part here, and I'll do the thunder, and you do the tubular bells, and we'll do the guitar, and et cetera. And that gave us the confidence to have a kind of singular approach. And then Joel and Ethan, they were there, and they would encourage or discourage whatever they liked or didn't like. So that gave us a sort of safe and bold way to go forward. And it also, in a way, that was, it was kind of the start of a new type of process where we just concentrated on the things that we liked. And we really only had one set of ideas going to the mix. And of course, they'd been vetted to a great degree by Joel and Ethan. And this way, we didn't spend much of our time, if any, during the mix, sorting stuff out. So it was only really make it louder or lower or take it out or something. We didn't have to audition a bunch of stuff, which was, that was the technology of the day. People still work that way with many, many options that you have to sort out during the mix. I'm amazed to see. We had understood then that it's so much more helpful and meaningful to the filmmakers for you to have your ideas and work on them to their logical extension, rather than try to come up with a bunch of ideas that someone has to then choose from.
And so today, when you collaborate with people, you're like, oh yeah, I'll just, you know, bounce this to a QuickTime movie and put it on Dropbox for you. Was Carter in New York with you guys? How were you sharing things back and forth in 1990?
we made little tapes. I guess we made DAT tapes or something. We did get to a point where we started emailing mixes to each other, but that was much later. I mean, when did the web even begin?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, well, we certainly weren't emailing in Barton Fink, but we made DAT tapes or quarter-inch tapes or something and sent audio over to Carter. And I can't be sure if this was Barton Fink, but I think we made little tapes where we would play audio from the scene, dialogue from the dailies, you know, from the actors. And so we'd let a little of that play, and then we'd close that, and then you'd play the sound. And that gave you a sync reference, so we could freely transfer that to quarter inch or something and send it over. And, you know, for this purpose, we were just an example. It wasn't meant to be used as a unit, so it didn't have to be perfect sync or otherwise. In fact, he could have just listened to it. We could have made a little mix and he listened to it just as easily. I'm not... As many times as we've talked about this, I honestly can't remember how we did it physically.
Yes, but something new. All right.
That's a scoop. You can quote me on that. I don't know how we did it. I think we did it in some way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, it was a long time ago and a lot has changed since then. And you don't think about like, oh, I got to lay this back to tape and we got to like bike messenger it across town or like whatever, you know, it's not a thought anymore. So It's kind of interesting to share those stories of the analog days. Like, would you make a mixtape?
Yeah. You know, it might've been a CD because we had writable CDs back in the day. It could have been that. I would say that, this is a good time to point out what my friend Jonathan Demme used to say, which was being able to make a lot of versions of the film. He was talking about picture editing. And you could make a couple versions a day, and you could certainly have many versions per week. And you could have other people's versions, which he was obviously not a fan of having multiple versions of the movie. But the idea that you could look at a bunch of different approaches and maybe select the best things from each one and compile those into the edit of the movie. He basically said, what if it takes a week to figure out what's the best version of the movie? And if you're being shown a new version of that movie every few hours, how are you ever going to remember or be aware? Or how would you even know if you're looking at it, whether it's the very best one? How would you know if it's one of many?
Yeah.
That's worth, you know, I'm not advocating to go back to mag and film, but just being able to do a lot of versions is important for some things, but it's probably to the detriment of other things.
And so was there any scene on Barton Fink that had some versions? Like, was there a scene that you revisited several times or experimented?
Yes.
Okay, great. So tell me about one of those scenes and what some of your different ideas were and when you got that like, aha, yes, this is it sort of feeling.
Well, I guess probably the prime example would be the very opening sequence where Barton checks into the Hotel Earl, which scripted is basically it says Barton arrives in Los Angeles and checks into the hotel in this cavernous room with, you know, well, they kind of got busy when they described that lobby. It's huge in the film, gigantic soundstage room. And he goes up to the desk and there's nobody there. And he hits the desk bell and he hears this sound transforming and echoing in this cavernous room. And then finally, he hears footsteps from down below, and he hears someone approaching up the stairs. And finally, then Steve Buscemi kicks open the subterranean submarine hatch and emerges up into the check-in counter and says, "Hi, my name is Chet. Welcome to Los Angeles, Mr. Fink." So that was pretty much the first thing that I did on my new toy. And I took the opportunity to really get out there with the sounds. And I made a bunch of bell sounds. And maybe I can find that. It would be nice to dig that up.
Yeah.
The original sound. But anyway, it was a little bit too much for Joel and Ethan. I turned around and looked at them at one point, and they were both like in shock. So I said, okay, so you want something more elemental. Yeah, okay. So doing the total opposite of that experiment, I went the most elemental you could be, which was the recorded sound of one of those bells. And that bell had it was quite a long time between when he rings the bell, and then finally Buscemi comes upstairs. And at a certain moment, he reaches over and touches the bell. So the bell needs to be ringing that entire time. It was a crucial bit of fun. And the recordings that we had of the hotel bell were just real recordings, and they were authentic, real recordings. So the hotel bell stops ringing physically after about, let's say, 30 seconds. But the time between when he touches it and when Buscemi quiets the bell is really quite long. It's like a minute and a half, I guess, something like that. So I realized that once the bell gets pretty quiet, after the first, let's say, 20 seconds, all the overtones have gone away, and it's just the fundamental. And so that's a sine wave of about, let's say, 500 cycles or 1,000 cycles. I don't remember. And because it's metal, there's probably some clangorous overtones the way metal bell sounds are. But I cranked up my oscillator, and I just tuned it to that frequency, and I made a chunk of it, like a minute recording, and I put that in my SyncLav. And when Barton hits the bell, I started that sound playing, so it's always there. And as the bell, the real recording, naturally quiets down and eventually stops sounding, the tone is there, the artificial tone is always there. And you can actually play it pretty low and you still register it. And then we had it loud enough so that when Buscemi touches it, you hear it clearly, hear it end. And they're like, "Yes, that's it. Yes, perfect." yeah, that's the way. Some things are like that, you know. Sometimes it's big and crazy, and sometimes it's just the tone. I will tell you that a story that I'm quite fond of, that year in the awards process was the year of Terminator 2, which was spectacular by any measure. It's one of the all-time great sound jobs, and it's an amazing film as well. And that was my friend Gary Rydstrom's handiwork. And in the sound award world, there's the Oscars, there's the CES, which is for mixing, and the MPSC, which is for sound editing. And in those days, that awards process was run by a lady named Ethel Crutcher. And she called me up one day and she said, "Congratulations. Of the 7 top voted films, 3 of them are yours." It was Cape Fear, Silence of the Lambs, and Barton Fink. And I said, "Oh, that's fantastic." And Ethel says, "Well, would you mind choosing one so more people can participate?" And I'm like, "Oh."
It's really funny. That's such a Sophie's Choice moment. Like, you know, which one of your babies do you want to keep?
That's a kind of a strange penalty. But I'm like, "Yeah, okay, all right, here's the thing. I'm sure Gary's going to win all the awards, and he certainly deserves to win. So I think I'd like to lose with Barton Fink." And she said, "Okay, good choice." So, okay, cut to March or whenever it was, and 3 a.m., my phone starts ringing. All of my friends who went to the awards ceremony start screaming, "You won, you won, you won." And against all measurable odds, we beat Terminator 2. And the place went nuts. And they showed that clip of him playing the bell. And there was like a 2-minute standing ovation for the clip, for the sound.
For the bell ring.
For a bell ringing. The most elemental sound, for two sounds, a real bell and a tone. It's pretty amazing. And Gary, of course, I don't think there are two sounds for anything in that movie. I mean, everything is comprised of a million sounds. But Gary told me that he was there at the ceremony, of course, expecting to win. They won both of the Oscars that year. And he told me that Greg Russell, a friend of ours, presented the award. And when he said, and the winner is, Gary and his whole table started to like get up and go to the stage. And they said, Barton Fink, and Gary and his whole crew had to kind of sit back down again. Gary has, I think he has like 8 Oscars now, so I'm sure he's not that disappointed that he didn't get the MPS. Anyway, I have to say that is, I wasn't there, of course. I didn't enjoy that moment until years later when I got an award from that group. And I got to, just a few years ago, thank them for that award.
So I spoke with your colleague, Rich Bologna, not too long ago. And the Barton Fink door whoosh came up in conversation and how he tries to slip that sound into pretty much every movie that he works on. So you got to tell me about the Barton Fink door whoosh. How did you make that sound? What makes this whoosh a standout whoosh?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just, to me, the Barton Fink is standing alone in a field. And I think all the other movies are pretty similar in one way or another. Well, first off, that it's a door whoosh in the first place is pretty extraordinary. Not exactly a featured sound in many films. But we had a Foley stage on 27th Street that, to deal with the air conditioning, we had this like double door lock. I'm not really sure why we had this physical air pressure difference, but we did. And so when you opened the door to the Foley stage, you got this sound effect that went. We all thought that was pretty funny. It's not the funniest door sound I've ever heard, but it's definitely top 10. And so we have with the Coens, we have an enjoyment expander where we make funny sounds and play them during the course of the mix. And it's essentially a fart track. And whenever it looks like someone's suffering, we put in a fart sound and we all get a laugh. And, you know, it's not something it's fun. And it was very fun on the day. And Joel and Ethan, I'm sure, would be disappointed if I said it was not my most proudest sound editing. But we did make a fart track for Buster Scruggs, which achieved beyond all possibility. And only after a few reels, we had to stop playing it because it was too funny. In those formative days, it wasn't just farts. There were other sounds we put in. And so when Barton gets to his hotel room, he's in this weird otherworldly building. We had the idea that the room would be isolated from the rest of the building and it would be actually air sealed and would be completely a sealed chamber. And then, of course, if you open the door to the room, you would hear the air whoosh. This is the theory of the joke, okay? So I put that in the first few times when he arrives and he opens the door. And Joel and Ethan, I don't know if you're aware, but they have a kind of distinctive laugh. So they started laughing and it was really quite a big deal. And it was by far the most thoroughly enjoyed fart sound that we've ever made. And so we get a little further into the scene and the door opens and closes a few more times. And, you know, I didn't put the joke there. And Ethan was like, wait, where's the door? Where's the door sound? So it became, we put it in. Unlike the fart jokes, they never go in the movie, but this joke went in the movie. So that whenever Barton, generally when he opens the door, there are a few places where it was just sort of annoying, but generally when he opens the door, you hear that sound. And it's quite entertaining, I think, for a sound effect.
Yeah, it's like his room is hermetically sealed.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So I just have time for one more question, but I did want to bring up the fact that there was a lot of press coverage on the sound of Barton Fink. I mean, Walter Murch wrote a story on the sound of Barton Fink for the 2013 summer issue of CAS Quarterly. I mean, that's how top notch the sound of this film is. Walter Murch freaking wrote about it. So, So my final question here. So was there anything that you learned while working on Barton Fink that shaped you as a sound designer, that like influenced how you see the role of sound in filmmaking, or has impacted your personal approach or your personal philosophy toward sound design?
Absolutely. There are two things, at least, two things that I can think of right off the top of my head that I learned from Barton Fink. One is, as a technician, I learned to always do the hardest thing first. And you may have read how I did the sound for the mosquito that bites Judy Davis and somehow leads to her death, or is related to her death. But the idea was that Barton's room had mosquitoes in it, and every time he would show up to a meeting, he'd have mosquito bites, and people would say, "What are you talking about, Fink? There are no mosquitoes in Los Angeles." So it was a key sound. The mosquito sound and the peeling wallpaper were key subtle sounds that we wanted to be present and exaggerated enough to hear and to get into Barton Fink's head via these two avenues. So we didn't have much in the way of mosquito recordings in our possession, and we tried recording some stuff, and it wasn't productive. But there were flies and bee sounds, and I started processing those into what I thought would be suitable. And Tony was like, "Yeah, it's pretty good, but it doesn't really sound like a mosquito." And so I hit on this little formula of speeding, getting the sound to be roughly in sync with the picture. And then it had to do certain things within the scene for Barton to track it and convey the ideas. And so I had made the sound, edited together sounds of flies that I then pitched up. So it was a much higher pitch than a fly. And that was really, we were getting there. It was really starting to sound like a mosquito might sound. And then I had a dream. And in the dream, I was in the Colony Record Store, which is on the ground floor of the Brill Building. The Brill Building is where we used to edit and mix, and where Joel and Ethan edited. And so I walked outside the record store, and a person thrust this toy into my face, and it was a plastic bug, and the bug was buzzing. And I got sort of knocked over, and then I kept going. And the next morning, I realized that if I took the sound that I had made and kind of fly it into the microphone in a kind of sync with the picture, that I could simulate the movement that we were so missing. And also, I could do it in a stereo recording, so I could make it go from side to side. And so that's what I did. I took my recording and I put a small speaker on a broomstick, and I flew it around the microphones. And I created a mosquito flight plus ambience recording. And that's what's in the movie.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Yes.
It works so well, though. I mean, it just does. It sounds like a mosquito flying around the room. So, mission accomplished.
Yeah, but I feel like it's a bit of a cheat if you actually have to dream of something to figure out how to do it.
No way. Inspiration comes from everywhere. Good for you for tapping into it, man.
Yeah, I'm eternally grateful for getting a night's sleep that night.
So, yeah, that was all of my questions. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention or talk about in this movie that we didn't cover?
Oh, my head is swimming. I can't... Thank you for asking a lot of really nice questions.
Thank you for doing this.
I did an interview, a commentary for Criterion, and at the end of the story, the filmmaker said, "Would you mind repeating that story that you told me at the New York Film Festival or something like that?" And I'm like, I can't remember that story. Can you give me a clue? I don't remember those stories as well as I should. And I'm grateful that you can prod me to get to the right place. Thank you.
Hey, man, you are a legend. I'm a huge fan of all of your stuff. So thank you, seriously, for taking some time out to share your story with me. Like, I know you're a busy guy, and I really appreciate that. So thank you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
A big thanks to Skip Livesay for the story behind the sound of Barton Fink, and to Jennifer Walden for the interview. Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a handpicked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org. That's it for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and take care.